This is a podcast from Minute Media.
You are listening to the One Good Scare podcast with Natalie Zamora and Max Mallow.
Hey everyone, welcome back to a new episode of the One Good Scare podcast. I'm Natalie Zamora and I'm joined by Max Mallow, of course, and today we have our final review of Midnight Mass, talking all about the finale, which is just so many emotions, so many things to talk about, and yeah, I'm sad we've come to an end, but maybe that just means I need to rewatch the show again.
Yeah, I rewatched the finale this morning to prep for the episode, and definitely feels like, sometimes I think, some of our listeners like, did they forget something? Because we both have really good memories, but... Mm-hmm. We tend to not, you know, we tend to watch something, write up our script, and then go with the episode. This I wanted to rewatch and just, you know, make sure I was in the right mindset. And man, just sitting at my desk this morning watching this episode was just tearing me up inside because of all the different emotions that are just on display across all the characters and how this miniseries comes to an end. It's heartbreaking. And... I'm super excited to talk about this episode because it's definitely a fulfilling conclusion, I feel. Some might not feel that way, but I think we're both in the same boat that this ties up everything. There's some things that are left up to just viewers to and fans to discuss and theorize about, but there's a pretty, you know, succinct conclusion to it. And it's, yeah, like you said, super emotional. And I know, so you've done... Obviously, if everyone doesn't know, Natalie's just podcast extraordinaire here at Fansided. So Natalie has done two other podcasts today, but I was telling her, like, you got to get in the mindset. Like, this is the finale of our show of the year, easily.
Yeah.
So go listen to Natalie's other podcasts. I'm not cool enough to be on other podcasts, but yeah, super excited to talk about this episode with you. It's crazy. It's so emotional.
Yeah, and I think, too, just thinking back to it and kind of coming up with, you know, an outline of events that happened, there's so much that we can't skip, not only because it's a big event, but I think because by this episode, we're so involved in every single character. Like, I care about every character, and I don't know if that's a common thing. I feel like usually my, like, critique of a show or movie would be, like, I don't care about these characters. Like, there's no stakes because I don't care. But with these ones, I'm like, every little small character, I need to know exactly what happens. And everyone has such, like, a complex and emotional journey that I think that's one of the best parts.
Yeah, every character in the show is amazing. From the protagonists to the antagonists to the ones that are in the middle and you don't know where they lie. It's awesome to see how much time and dedication was put into crafting these characters by all the writers involved, Mike Flanagan. It's just, honestly, the closest thing to a masterpiece, I think, that we've reviewed this year. I'm really glad that we have the full episode to talk about just episode 7. I think if we could have gone back and done one episode per podcast... that would have been good because there's so much that perhaps we didn't talk about that some of our listeners thought we might have missed. But, you know, glad we're doing it for the finale because we can go through the entire episode and talk about everything without trying to cram other stuff in. But, of course, at the end as well, we'll be able to talk about, you know, our full thoughts on the show and some of the theories and ideas that we've been hinting at and kind of, you know, foreshadowing a little bit in the rest of our reviews because... It's pretty ambiguous as to, you know, the whole mythology behind the show. So, super excited to talk about all of that. And I hope everyone enjoys and goes and listens to the rest of our review. If you haven't so far, if you're just seeing what our thoughts were on episode 7 and you watch the show, go back and listen to it. Go check out our review, our interview, I should say, with Crystal Belint, who plays Dolly Scarborough on the show. Was awesome to talk to her as well. And... Not only am I emotional that we're going to be reviewing this episode, I'm emotional that our review of this whole show has come to an end. What are we going to do now?
I know. Everything we review after this will be such a disappointment.
I know. It's like, it's when we were talking about this as well. Like, we're like, okay, things we're most excited for this year. everyone knows Halloween Kills was that thing. And we were like, okay, we're going to review this and then we'll talk about Midnight Mass. But as disappointing as Halloween Kills was, this was everything we wanted from a release this year. And, you know, it filled that void that now we know will be filled next summer or whenever it is, Stranger Things 4. Super excited for that. Definitely going to review that on this show because that falls into some kind of horror-adjacent type of world. But, yeah, Netflix, I know we were very critical of them, I want to say a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
When talking about, you know, the lack of horror that they were having on their platform. And, man, this show, for me, just wiped all those worries away.
Restored your faith in Netflix.
Yeah, the big N, the big red N on that black box. No more Amazon Prime for me. No more Hulu. None of that. Just the big Netflix.
Okay, so should we get into it?
I don't know. I'm not ready yet. I'm so sad. Let's stall for. Okay, so everyone knows we haven't done weekly horror news roundups for these episodes because we've had so much to cram in.
So much to talk about, yeah.
This will be the last episode without a weekly horror news roundup as well. But yeah, let's do it. Book 7, Revelation.
Revelation, yeah. And I like this show so much just because we're getting into the finale, I promise. But one last thing about the finale is that every episode kind of takes place where the last one ended. So there's not a lot of time jumps, which I think is a good choice on their part. So episode 7 starts off right where episode 6 ended. Remember all the chaos that just happened at the hands of Bev and Pruitt. Bev opened the church doors, and now all of the dead people who have come back to life are ready to feed. They're zombie, vampire, religious things. Don't know. Apostles, I guess. I'm not religious. So yeah. I don't know if apostles ever did anything like this, but maybe in some form of book they did. So it starts off where we left off. Mildred is the first person we see who, speaking of just characters you've come to love, I am so attached to her by the finale, just seeing her journey of becoming younger again and her relationship with Sarah. I just love her. So she awakens from the dead. We remember that the creature took her out last episode, which was shocking. So she's back. But of course, there are implications because she came back from the dead. And then we get to kind of see the chaos that Bev started by opening the doors. People are just eating everyone outside. And there's kind of like these two groups now. There's Bev and just everyone who had died and come back to life who are, for lack of a better word, kind of just going crazy, eating each other and causing chaos. And then we have kind of what I want to call like our survivors, the smart people that didn't drink the Kool-Aid. And they're kind of in this room trying to figure out how to stop everyone. And that's who we said last week. It was Aaron, Hassan, Lisa, Warren, Sarah, and Riley's mom, Annie.
Right. I want to mention, too, I love the parallel between Mildred coming back to life and Pruitt coming back to life, because that mm-hmm. will be a big focus of this episode that we'll get into, with how episode 3 ended with Bev holding John in her arms as he was poisoned, as we know, and came back to life, jumps up from off screen. Same way Mildred comes back to life here at the beginning of the episode. And when she walks in, obviously John doesn't know what happened to her because she shot him in the head.
Mm-hmm.
And he's very distraught. He's like, did it hurt you? You know, what's going on? And he seems very emotionally torn over what has transpired tonight. And that, to me, and what his arc is for this episode, cements to me that this is like one of the best TV characters I've seen ever. You know, characters from The Leftovers, Kevin and Nora, stand out to me as being some of my favorite TV characters of all time. But Hamish Linklater did such a phenomenal job portraying this character, and his arc is like masterfully written. But yeah, I just wanted to mention that. Yeah, the town is falling fucking apart. It's going crazy. People are being dragged out of their homes and being eaten. It's not how John, I think, you know, foresaw it in his mind, where he was talking about those being chosen to follow in this new world. Mm-hmm. And the people are just out of their minds. They're ravenous. They're hungry. They don't know what to do. And that whole idea of being chosen has been kind of put to the side. And it's definitely mentioned later on the episode, which is great. But yeah, our survivors, as you've called them, and I think that's an apt name for them, are trying to figure out what to do. Aaron is definitely trying to figure out alongside Sarah what the best course of action is, since, you know, they were teaming up to begin with, and Sheriff Hassan as well. I feel terrible for Lisa and Warren because their lives are falling apart. Lisa's parents are gone to this crazy mob. And obviously Ed, Andy's husband, Riley's dad, Warren's dad, is now missing because he got taken away at the church. And they're kind of just trying to figure out what to do, like, what is our best course of action? But we're rudely interrupted by Bev and Sturge, because a Molotov cocktail just comes flying through the window. And it's definitely startling, because I was not expecting this to happen. But we get this awesome showdown between Bev and Annie here as the rest of our characters try to flee. And Bev is, like, bone-chilling in this scene. And mm-hmm. Annie, across from her, is just, like, breaking my heart as she's being this decoy distraction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, another part of this episode for the survivors is they keep saying, like, we just need a few minutes. Like, we need to stall them. I think, you know, they take out knives and guns, and people are like, that's obviously not going to kill them. They're already dead. But Aaron's like, no, we just need a few minutes. We just need to be able to stop them and, you know, distract them and get away. So I think that's, you know, exactly what's on Annie's mind when she goes out as a distraction. And Bev is, it is just so crazy, because no matter what is going on with the angel creature blood and the religious aspects, Bev is just a villain. She is crazy, terrible person. And just, like, I think the villain of this show, for sure, especially when we hear more about Pruitt and his background. She has no remorse, absolutely. And at this point, who is she following? Like, Pruitt is over it. She's just like, all right, I committed. I'm just seeing this all the way through now.
Yeah, the idea of what this transformation that happens in the show with all the characters is talked about in this episode a bunch. And we get a conversation with Ed and Annie later on. But the idea of the transformation doesn't necessarily change who you are as a person. It just mm-hmm. makes you immortal, more or yeah. less, and what you do with that. The whole idea of ravenous hunger and feeding is kind of a side effect, I would say, because, you know, what we know from, like, vampiric media and stuff like that, and knowing that when you first turn, you know, you're starving because you're idea of sustenance is no longer, you know, hamburgers and french fries or something. It's human blood. So I love that dynamic that's talked about later, and we'll definitely talk about it because that conversation is super important. But yeah, Bev is like, Aaron Green, come outside and talk to me. And Sturge, mm-hmm. who's with her, and I love Sturge in this episode, who definitely seemed like the lackey and the one who was carrying out a lot of the mm-hmm. wrongdoing, especially last episode. But there's a character shift in him in this episode that I love. And he's like, how do you know she's in there? And she's like, I know. And at this point, I'm like, yo, someone's got to get her. And it's Annie who steps up. And she, again, is talking in this holier-than-thou type of vibe, but that's been amplified. And she's like, I have no issue with you, Annie Flynn. And mm-hmm. Annie's just like, you know what, Bev, I gotta tell you something that you've been needing to hear a long time. And I'm like, oh, what is she gonna hit her with? Like, she's gonna say something. And she just goes, you're not a good person. And, like, that seems to, like, startle Bev in some kind of yeah. way, where you think that, you know, Bev's this immortal being now. Nothing really bothers her, except for the sunlight, of course. and Annie goes on this little bit of a speech to stall time, obviously. But the whole idea that she presents to Bev is what we're all thinking, and you see it, you know, play out in Bev's eyes, is that Bev can't stand the fact that God loves people just as much as God loves Bev.
Mm-hmm.
Bev wants to be loved by God more than anybody. And Bev then uses Riley as a way to get under her skin, because she's saying, like, Riley was a drunk and a murderer. And he's like, nope, God loves and forgives just as much. And, you know, that definitely drives Bev insane. But she doesn't, you know, let it distract her from her, you know, her calling. Because she's like, okay, yeah, I'm not going to let you know that what you just said fucking pissed me off. But she's stalling. Do something. And in that moment, Annie does the ultimate sacrifice by slitting her own throat with the knife. And that turns out to be the best distraction as possible, because we know Annie obviously had drank the blood, so she was going to come back to life regardless. But it's so sad to watch as she's like dying.
Mm-hmm.
And Bev is like, don't worry, you'll be back in a couple minutes. Everything will be fine. And then her and Sturge are both just like, oh shit, she looks tasty.
Yeah, I know. I was shocked that Annie did that. I mean, in retrospect, it does make some sense. She's trying to stall. She wants to save her son, Warren, who's in there, who's trying to get out of there. And, you know, her husband, Ed, there's no way he survived that mob in the church. So I'm assuming her feeling is, I'm going to go be with my husband. Hopefully this means my son can get out. He has his whole life ahead of him. So hopefully I can help him by doing this. But yeah. That was shocking.
Super shocking. Fantastic scene. A drastic change. And I know I think some people might feel like that some of these character developments are jarring, because last episode we saw Annie was like, Aaron, get the fuck off my porch and stop fucking assuming that my son is dead. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. To now wanting to save her son. But, you know, it is a little fast in that aspect. I still think it works. I still think a lot of the characters snap out of it in that whole church scene from episode 6. So, yeah, it's definitely heartbreaking to watch. But from there, we go back to Mildred and Pruitt, who are hanging out at the church. And this is the big revelation, so to say, of John and why he's here and why he did what he did coming back from Jerusalem. And watching this the first time, I was like, okay, you know, that motivation's a little silly. But watching it again this morning to prep for the episode, I was like, damn. Like, I get it. I get you, Pruitt. Like, I understand why you did this. It's fucked up what you did, and I understand it got out of your control.
Yeah.
But, like, listening to him, and especially Hamish, tell his entire story and how his arc finishes in this episode is fucking amazing.
I agree. I love this part. I think it's so special, and I'm really glad that they included it and didn't just say, you know, Pruitt was just trying to do something good, you know. No, it comes out that he did everything that he did. He snuck the creature over back to Crockett Island and lied to everyone, did everything that he kind of confessed when he was in confession, that it was because he wanted to be with Mildred and Sarah. He wanted Mildred to live because, as we remember in the beginning of the season, she's not doing well at all. She has dementia. She has to stay on one floor. She's just very, very ill. So he wanted to save her, and he wanted to be with her and Sarah. And that's because way back when, Pruitt and Mildred were in love, and Sarah is Pruitt's daughter, which I didn't see it coming, and I don't think it's cheesy. I really like it.
Yeah, I don't think it's cheesy either. I like that aspect of it. This probably feels like the most rushed thing in the entire show, I would say, because they have to kind of do this and wrap it up all in one episode. But I still think it works as a motivation. I think Hamish does a great job, especially explaining everything, and then Mildred, and the way that she responds to it, and this whole idea throughout the episode of, like, judging people for what has happened is more or less irrelevant. You know, it's mm-hmm. more, do you forgive the person for the sins that they've committed?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
I think that's a very powerful theme to kind of take place throughout the entire finale. And yeah, it's a crazy reveal, that Sarah is in fact his daughter. Of course, priests aren't allowed to have children.
To be honest, I don't think they are allowed, but obviously it can happen.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's physically possible. I just don't think you're supposed to.
Wouldn't be an episode of our Midnight Mass Review without questions about religious factors.
Yeah, because they're not allowed to be married.
Right. But it explains when at the potluck way back, that John was like creepily staring at her.
Yep.
And was mm-hmm. like, hey, the old priest used to do that too. This is when he was still Father Paul.
Yeah.
And that explains it, because he was watching over her and making sure that she was safe, instead of what, cause I think she teases a relationship a little bit, I think, in the show.
Yeah. She had a woman with her at that.
Right.
Thing, that event.
Yeah. And the woman was like, oh, you know.
From the mainland, yeah.
The priest is checking you out, you know. He thinks you're committing a sin mm-hmm. against the church. And she's like, that's weird. He, you know, the other guy used to stare at me all the time, too. I guess they're both just homophobic.
Or just creepy.
Right. But it comes from a place of he was her father, unbeknowingly to her. It's a big part of the rest of this episode as well. Because it kickstarts Pruitt's redemption, more or less. So I don't want to say redemption, but his arc of forgiveness among the people that he loves.
Yeah, I feel like it's his redemption, just because now we know why he did everything. It's not like he does anything after this that's like, I'm going to set things right again. It's just like, now we know where he's coming from. So it's like, okay. That makes more sense. I do really love that, his motivations, because it kind of just goes back to what we keep saying every episode about these characters doing things just out of blind faith because their loved ones are getting better. And, you know, for him to not know what he was going to be sacrificing, he doesn't know what damage this creature could bring to Crockett Island, but it didn't seem like it mattered compared to the fact that he might have Mildred back and he might have just a moment of living a life with his love and his daughter. And that's just, it's just so humanizing for him, for someone that seemed so out of this world and scary at times, evil at times, confusing at times. I think this is where we really look at him and think, okay, I understand that.
Yeah. I think Alex Esso, I hope I pronounced her last name correctly, who plays Mildred, you know, does a great job at just being there to take on all the emotions that John is emitting. And I think as the viewers, we all need to know that they loved each other for decades. Like, they've been in love for a long, long time. So that might seem like it's a little jarring at some points for viewers, but just remember to take that on board. Because the scenes that they have together for the rest of this this finale are super emotional. From there, we go back to all hell is breaking loose.
Chaos.
Yeah, straight up chaos. Because, and we probably take our first break here, Bev and Sturge are, they're going crazy with some fire.
Yeah, evil, at least for Bev. But yeah, let's take our first quick break and then we'll be right back. So yeah, Bev is, like you said, Sturge is very much just her lackey. She's like, do this, do that, do that. So they're burning everything down. The idea is that they'll have kind of the church to be pure, right? And the rec center, we'll see in a little bit that Bev is setting up just for people to sleep in because they can't be outside during the light. You would think, though, you might want to keep more than two places open, just in case, but whatever, just whatever. And this isn't a shot at the show, it's just at her.
Yeah, the hubris is definitely coming out here. at this point, because they don't want more or less anybody who hasn't been chosen to survive the night. And those who enter the rec center will be chosen. And that leads to our survivors, Sheriff Hassan, Aaron, Sarah, Warren, and Lisa, to kind of hatch a plan, because they figure out that, you know, the boats are still there. They need to take the boats off of Crockett Island and go to the mainland, and that's how they will go off on this journey to shape the world in their eyes, because if one person gets off mainland, it'll be really, really bad for everybody. But also at the same time, that angel thing was, like, living for a long time, and, you know, nothing else crazy seemed to happen. But that's nitpicking too much. And I, you know, we like to nitpick, but we're not going to do it right now. Warren and Aliza, they head off to the Upwards to get into a canoe in the kind of same way that Riley and Aaron did to survive the night, to go into the water. While Sheriff Hassan, Aaron, and Sarah hatch a plan to get rid of all the boats. So as the boats are burning, all the houses are burning, it's going to create this chaotic situation where there is nowhere to go, because while Bev and Sturge, like you said, are creating this haven for everyone who's been chosen for the daytime, our survivors want to make sure that there's nowhere to go for them, and they all burn to a crisp when the sun comes up. And we get this awesome shot as this is going on, because, you know, there's a lot of big aerial shots of the entire island as it's burning throughout the night. And when they're at the pier and they start torching all the boats, you know, you could see that it's all kind of leading to this entire island just being set aflame, and, you know, it'll burn, and whatever comes from it will be anew, and et cetera, et cetera. It's an awesome shot. But we also get this moment when they're trying to get to the pier to figure out this plan. Cause at first they're like, okay, cool. Let's get on the boats. Let's get the hell out of here. They come across this woman who's being attacked by the angel. Like, the angel just swoops into her house and starts eating her. She runs out, and it shows how crazy the town is, because she runs out. They just, like, pan the camera to these two people who are just feasting in the middle of the lawn. And they're just like, oh, more food. And I'm like, this is terrifying. Like, it's definitely like zombie apocalypse type of vibes, where everything is falling apart around you. And it gives a good sense of how chaotic and terrible this entire situation is.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny because it's like, it's very zombie-like, but the people are, like, they're able to speak. They're you know, human as well. So it's like a weird, like, vampire-zombie hybrid, where I feel like vampires are more, I don't know, sophisticated, put together, you know? They're, like, real people. They just might be a little bit evil, but then zombies are obviously brain dead. So it's funny that it's kind of this in-between. And it's hard because I'm sure you don't know who to trust. It's like people that you grew up with your entire life on Crockett Island. You don't know if what they are, who they are. So it's basically just like you can't trust anybody. And I think the next part too, this is the one part that I just laughed out loud at, because it was just a little bit strange. When Lisa and Warren are, they see the angel just eating on someone. And Lisa is like, shoots it, and of course Warren is like, oh my god, don't do it, don't do anything. And she shoots it once, and like his wing is like cut, and he's like reacts to it, and he like tries to like tell them to go away. He like I don't even know how to describe it, but it just took me out of the moment, and I was laughing so hard to just think of this like creature being like, fuck off, go away.
Like, yeah, like imagine it's like your dog is like eating, like, say you have two dogs, right? I've had a bunch of dogs my entire life. As soon as they get the food in front of them, it's like snout into bowl, don't disturb them while they're eating. Until they're finished, don't bother them. Like, you could try to distract them with anything, and they're just like, nah, I'm hungry, I'm gonna eat. And yeah, it's a little weird, because just like, if I was the angel, I think if someone shot me, I'd be like, the fuck?
Yeah, and just attack the person.
Right. There is some nitpicking there that we need to do. I agree. But
he just, like, shoos them away. Just like, no, go.
Right.
And without talking.
I think that scene is in there just to foreshadow something else that happens later on in the finale, which is, I understand it. Because, like, if what happens when we talk about it later on just was, like, out of the blue, would be like, that's really fucking weird. Like, what the hell? So Flanagan was like, let's just do this now and get this out of the way so that it makes sense later on. But, yeah, it's weird. The awesome thing, though, about this leading up to it, and we mentioned, like, the character journeys and everything like that, right? That whole idea that you were talking about of minutes continues to be pushed along. Mm-hmm. And at a point, Lisa and Warren go to Joe Colley's trailer, where it's, for me, like this whole big circle that has been completed in Lisa's life, where, you know, she was paralyzed from the waist down because of Joe and this gun, this rifle that's in his trailer. Mm-hmm. And she goes there knowing that that rifle will buy her more minutes of her life, which I think is beautiful storytelling. Mm-hmm. Fantastic stuff. But yeah, they use it in a way to shoot an angel, and the angel's kind of just like, bro, what are you doing? I'm hungry. Like, stop it. And then Lisa has a better idea, because she's like, okay, well, if he's not bothered by gunshots, yeah, I'm just going to throw a bunch of gasoline on him. And even then, if I was the angel, I'd be like, dude, what are you doing? Like, stop it. And yeah, they light the angel on fire. They go out of the house. They throw a match. Boom, fire. I don't know what it is about Hollywood and stuff like that, but people love doing those like things. Yeah. The angel flies out on fire. Warren and Lisa are definitely like, holy crap, did we do it? But comes along Sturge, and Sturge is like, Lisa Scarbrough, your dad's looking for you. I'm just like, run. Like, get the hell out of there. And they scurry away. But then we get a family reunion. We get Annie, who has come back from the dead, obviously. Stumbles across Ed, who's just kind of been wandering across town, figuring out what's going on. And this is where that humanity aspect that I talked about comes back to play, because the conversation between them two is heartbreaking, but it's fantastic lore and explanation as to what's going on.
Yeah, I do, even though I had like ups and downs with Annie, just, I don't know, them together in the end was just so sweet, even though it's terrible because we don't know what's going to happen in the end, but they're dead, so not much good can come from it. But I feel like it was just so nice to see them reunite and kind of be like, whatever happens is just going to happen and we're going to do it together.
Yeah. The whole idea of, like, she's like, I'm starving. And he's like, I am too, but I'm still me. Like, I'm not going to do it. I think is like powerful stuff and does a great job at showcasing what this transformation is like. You know, it's not necessarily taking the humanity away from people, even though it essentially is. Because they've defied death, more or less. I think, a fitting ending for these two characters reunited to see what happens come sunrise, considering that they both lost both of their kids. For what Annie knows, she hopes he got away. Mm-hmm. She doesn't know one way or the other, but they both know that Riley died trying to make things right. So it's super powerful stuff. I like definitely started to tear up at this point with this conversation. But you know, the tears don't stop there, because it gets even sadder and it gets even more depressing and downright just straight up like grim. And I'm gonna say grim in like all the best ways, because some of the imagery that Flanagan does for the rest of the finale and some of the script writing is like so emotional, so thought provoking. It's just, emotional. We keep saying emotional, but that's what it is. Mm-hmm. It's so emotional.
I know, it really is. And then after this too, we get to see Bev reunite with Pruitt, the reunion we didn't need, but it is necessary to kind of close, give us closure for their relationship, because we do see Pruitt starting to come back around, and Bev is still the same. We're wondering what she's thinking, who she's following. But so she sets up the shelter and the rec center, kind of setting up beds in there. And then she heads to the church. Pruitt is still there. And basically he's like, you open the doors. Like, why did you do that? And he sees, you know, everything's on fire. She created all this chaos by encouraging these bloodthirsty people to go out and just do whatever they want. And this is when Pruitt really does prove that he's not supportive of this at all. He says, you know, we got this wrong. This isn't what was supposed to happen. You know, this isn't what I thought was going to happen, but obviously this is not a good situation. And Bev doesn't understand.
Yeah, Bev is completely confused. She's like, what do you mean? Like, what did I do? Yeah. And he, again, some of the dialogue that's delivered from Hamish here is so good, because he seems very anxious. He seems very out of control. He doesn't know what happened, even though he's been in control this entire time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he misses, I don't know, however many hours of action that he did because he was shot in the head. And he's like, this is crazy. This is not what I wanted. Even though, you know, deep down, maybe this is part of what he wanted. We just don't know how it could have, you know, played out in his view, because he was dead for a couple hours. And I can't remember the exact line, but he, you know, he's very calm with his tone, at least. It, you know, it sounds anxious. But then he explodes at her. And Bev, being Bev, just immediately flips on him, which is exactly what we think Bev would do in this situation. She feels no emotion towards the people, and all she's ever wanted to really be is in control and be the leader of everything, because she feels like she's been chosen. And she goes on this, again, this whole idea of everything in the world can be explained by the Bible, or something in the Bible was written and that it can be explained however I want to twist the words into that manner. And she's like, yeah, you know, Jesus said we shouldn't call anybody father on this earth, because there's only one father, and vipers brood, and some of the language that she used towards him, as, you know, you can see that it's just utter chaos. And she's just like, okay, well, if you're not going to lead these people that I've created for you, I'm going to lead them. It's my job now. And you can, you know, rot in hell, more or less. It's crazy how the situation just devolves massively in this episode.
Yeah, she definitely doesn't want to take any blame from it. If, you know, Pruitt obviously has come to the realization of what we started did not turn out the way it was supposed to. We did something wrong. And she's just like, nope, you know, everything's happening because it was supposed to happen. And like you said, the Bible verse and everything like that. She can't ever just sit for a second and be like, okay, maybe I was wrong. Yeah, no, that's not an option. Yeah, that was not an option.
The words my bad have never left her mouth.
or I'm sorry.
Yeah, anything like that. Anything apologetic. it is the first time I watched it, I kind of like chuckled a little bit, because she's like, the Ark, the rec center, Noah, and I've brought you your people. And
shut up.
And Hamish is just like, or John, I should say. I feel like I keep calling him Hamish. I'm like, yo, like, we want to be best buds with him, basically, is what we're saying. And he's just like, nah, we got this wrong. I'm like.
He's so defeated.
I know. He's just like, ah, crap. I screwed up.
Yeah, he's like, so this isn't chill anymore.
Right. He's like, I gotta be out. Like, this is, I don't know. But, yeah. Bev has taken all these people. We get the super ominous image as well of, like, the town burning behind them as they're walking towards the church. Mm-hmm. And all of these, you know, we criticized it a little bit, the glowy eyes.
Yeah.
Being a little silly as a special effect. Yeah. But it does give this, like, ominous feeling as they're all kind of aimlessly walking back towards the church and the rec center. And John says, like, you know, no, we're the wolves, like, you know, just roaming around, eating whatever we can, which is, I think, awesome script writing put to imagery in that sense. You know, it is a little strange as to, like, what the lights or the eyes necessarily mean, because we get a couple shots of characters throughout the season where, or the series, where, you know, they seem to see more of life, more or less, it's kind of shown. Because, like, lights emit more aura or something like that. It's very vampiric in that sense. But, yeah, I love that imagery with the eyes, even though it's a little corny.
Yeah, definitely. I think it made more sense now, just seeing everyone in a pack. And also when, you know, Pruitt is talking to Bev at this point, he's outside looking at everything that's going on. So then he decides to go back in the church, and that's when he sees Sarah pouring gas all over the inside, you know, with a plan to blow the church up, as one does. And, you know, just a casual activity. And, you know, we know now that he's her actual dad, and he's able to say he's proud of her. It seems like they're going to have a very emotional moment. But before that happens, Serge comes in and shoots Sarah.
Yeah. We get this scene that comes right before this, where, like, again, John's character is a roller coaster throughout this entire episode. It's up, it's down, it goes through loop de loops. But Bev starts to judge the people that are coming to the rec center.
Yes.
Where you can tell that she's, like, lost her mind. And she's like, you know, she's like, I thought.
It's personal at this point.
Right. She's like, okay, I'm in charge, I'm making the rules now. and there's this Howard Hobbs. Is his name, and he comes forward, and I feel so bad for this character. I think he was in the schoolroom when they were talking about the Bible and the Quran a couple episodes ago, but I'm not sure. But he is just a townsfolk, and I feel so sad for this guy, because he is, like, his life is over, more or less. Yeah. He doesn't know what's going on. He's like, I killed my wife, I killed my kids, I don't know what's happening, I'm looking for guidance, I'm here at the church, someone guide me. And Bev is like, I haven't seen you at church once. And I'm just like, yo, Bev, like, come on. And Sturge starts to speak up, and this is where all the dissent starts to sow between the group, because she's like, why'd you turn him? And he was like, he was always really nice to me, when no one else really was nice to me, more or less. And she's like, it's fine. It's okay. We'll talk about it later. But yeah, she's like, I don't know if you're allowed, man. Like, you're not on the list. Like, who do you know here? Like, it's very sad to watch, because his entire life is coming to a head in this moment. And in that moment, John just finds a renewed sense in faith, because he's just like, anyone who is welcome here, it's a house of God. If not, what would it be? I'm John Pruitt. and yeah, that's when he walks in and he sees Sarah. And that's when Sturge comes in and shoots him. Her. Sorry. And yeah, it's so sad. But it's also a little rushed at this point, I would say. Because, again, this whole love angle and the whole secret child, more or less, was just kind of dropped on us as a bombshell this episode. Because John's just like, I wish I got to know you more, I'm really sorry. And Sarah, at this point, I think, again, this is the whole idea of judgment and redemption and all that stuff. I don't think it necessarily matters. Like, as viewers, we can do that. And judge characters and if they're redeemed or not. But this overarching idea of just, like, in the moment, in your final, like, moments of life, do you forgive the person for the sins that they've committed? And Sarah's just like, yeah, I wish I got to know you more too.
And yeah.
It's just like a moment that we were like, oh, like, great. Like, the family's going to be reunited in the end. And then Sturge is just like, boom. And he's like, sorry, I thought I was, like, saving the day. And I'm just like, what the fuck is going on?
I know. Yeah, that was tough. I mean, all things considered, like, Pruitt and Mildred are dead, undead, whatever it is. So we don't know what's going to happen to them. But at least we thought maybe Sarah would have an out somehow. But no, unfortunately, that's not the case. And obviously, Pruitt is heartbroken, very angry at Serge for doing that. And it kind of just is what it is. And let's keep moving, because there's a lot of shit happening and a lot of people dying. Speaking of which, now that Hassan and Aaron have moved to the rec center, it seems like they've split up. So Sarah was going to the church.
Right.
Aaron and Hassan were going to the rec center. So they're pouring gas all over the building, but they get caught pretty quickly by Bev. Bev sees Hassan pouring gas and she shoots him in the leg pretty fast. And I feel like it's so interesting because we talked about his monologue, right, where he said, I don't want to get involved. I need to be nice and, like, pleasant, not scare people, because it's, you know, my experience that I just had after 9/11. I don't want that anymore. And after Ali is involved and, you know, drank the Kool-Aid last episode, I think he gives no fucks about that anymore, because after Bev shoots him in the leg, he just keeps shit-talking her. To the point where she shoots him for real.
Yeah. He says a badass line where he's like, you know, there's always this verse in the Bible that I really, really liked. It was like, the sun will rise on the evil just as it does the good. And, you know, foreshadowing that the sun will rise, it'll all burn to a crisp. And she, like, in, like, this is where, I don't want to say, like, Bev's villainhood is, like, cemented, but it's, mm-hmm. it definitely drives it home, because she's saying some extremely, racist, xenophobic, Islamophobic things to him, of being like, I bet you wished we were all in the building and stuff like that. Just awful things.
That have no connection with anything, really.
Right. It's just, like, just shows how awful and evil of a person she is. And when he says that line too, like, the first shot was to stop him from burning the building down. The second shot was just because she wanted to do it anyway, because mm-hmm. he said, he called her evil, and she just, like, does it nonchalantly too. She's just like, bang. And it's like super, just evil, just like rotten to the core, of her character. And it's like, we all knew along, we knew all along that she didn't like Sheriff Hassan for his beliefs and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. You know, again, Samantha Sloyan does an amazing job at portraying this character. The two buildings that are left, the church and the rec center, those are the arcs. Mildred walks in, and obviously, because John, like, tackled Sturge out of the church, and they rolled down the stairs. And Mildred's like, what happened? And she goes in, she sees that Sarah was shot, and as she's dying, John tries to bring her back to life. And this is very vampire imagery here. You know, biting of the wrist, trying to feed her the blood, and she spits it up. She's like, no, I don't want it. Like, this is where I'll die, and this is the end of my journey. And it's super sad. Like, this is where the tears started to flow, and I was like, god damn it. But the show doesn't give you time to, like, process that, because it goes right to the scene we're talking about with Bev and Hassan. And we're like, okay, crap, like, is this it? Like, did the bad guys win? Like, is this how the show will end? Mm-hmm. No, because Sheriff Hassan's like, yeah, like, there's one more person here, like, and out comes Aaron. And I just, like, this also kind of made me chuckle a little bit, because there's so much, like, commotion and hubbub happening outside. And Aaron just, like, stumbles out from inside the rec center with a can of gasoline. She's like, oh, hey, everybody. How you doing? John has set ablaze the church. The church is gone. And then we get a super, like, sad, emotional scene here again, because as Aaron is like, thinks that she's saved the day, nope, the angel comes out of nowhere and just straight up tackles her. And you get like a good like still shot, if you go back and pause it for anyone who watched it, of her just like in fear as the angel tackles her and pins her to the ground and starts feeding on her. And we're just super sad that this is the end of Aaron's character. But we get I won't say good guy, because obviously this character had drank the Kool-Aid. The unlikely protagonist that steps up, because we thought we forgot about, at least I did in the moment, I forgot about him. I was like, oh crap, they're going to win. Ali steps up because Aaron was going to set a blaze to the rec center with a lighter. But when she got tackled, she dropped the lighter. Ali steps up and is like, oh, hey. And Bev's like, give me the lighter. And he's just like, no. And he throws it and he sets the rec center ablaze.
Yeah, thank God, Ali, you did the right thing, finally. I think, obviously, seeing his dad being shot and, you know, on the ground and not okay is probably what caused him to finally do that, but thank God, we needed that. So let's take our final break, and then when we get back, let's talk more about Aaron. Okay, so this is when I was full-on crying. Aaron's final monologue, and what she does when this angel is on top of her, feeding off of her, is just, oh my God, just connecting so many different things. Such a great way to end her character arc. I'm not even that mad that she died, just because it was so satisfying the way that we got her final monologue and what she does.
Yeah. So like we mentioned, the little corny scene with Lisa and Warren kind of, you know, shooting and lighting the angel on fire, you know, minutes ago. As Aaron is being fed on, she takes one of the knives that they took from the house and she starts to cut into the angel's wings to, you know, prevent him from flying away. And the angel starts to be like, hey, what are you doing? Yeah. Like, stop doing that. But Aaron's like, no, I'm sacrificing myself. And she grabs the angel's head and, you know, pushes him back into her neck so he can continue feeding. So that explains all of that kind of angle when it comes to the angel is more preoccupied with eating than with saving its own life at a point. But yeah, the angel kind of is done eating and he stands up and just like looking around at his wings and is like, the fuck? And he tries to fly away, and you could tell he's having some struggle flying. But we get this shot, this overhead shot of Aaron lying on the ground with her neck. And I didn't notice this at first when I noticed it on my second watch, that her neck is just all torn up. The insides of the tendons and everything are just showing, and she's sitting there, and we hear Riley's voice. And this is, yeah, the full-on waterworks for this, for the rest of this episode. And Riley is asking her again, as she kind of flashes back to their conversation about life and death as she is dying, and her last thoughts about being home, safe with Riley, the man that she loved, and the man that loved her all along. And, like, God, just the shot, again, watching it, of Zach Guilford just sitting on her couch, just looking over at her, smiling, and being like, I'm here, I'm ready to welcome you to the afterlife, I'm waiting for you. And she talks about the idea of going back into the earth and the idea of God and being a drop in the ocean that was always there and just returning. Oh, man, it's so good. It's like, I don't know if it's my favorite one of the entire show, but it's got to be up there in terms of top five, top three monologues in the entire show.
I agree. And the scene is just very, very rich. Like, it's very emotional. There's just a lot of like symbolism coming at you really fast. And I think if there is a little bit more, it might have been too much, like Flanagan just trying too hard to include different things. But I think it was just right on the borderline of being too much. So I loved it. And I think, too, just going back to, you know, cutting the angel's wings, it's just kind of what she's heard her whole life, and something she's kept with her is her mom saying, you know, we all just have clipped wings, like, you know, basically saying bad things are going to happen to everyone. And, you know, this is something that Erin was hoping wouldn't happen. And she was so happy about having a baby, and just so sad. It really is.
Yeah. But also you see like the joy in her eyes as she talks, like she's happy of what life and death means to her. And like,
yes,
what happens when you die. And I don't know if in that final moment she's believing, like, okay, I'm going to go see Riley now, or any of that mm-hmm. aspect. But, you know, her whole character has been very honest with herself when it comes to the idea of life and death. And I think it's a beautiful way to show, I think, what will happen to the rest of our characters as well, the ones that we really cared about, and the rest of the townspeople who are now aimlessly wandering because the rec center is gone, the church is gone, there are no buildings left, there's nowhere to hide anymore on this island. Their final hours and minutes are upon them. And yeah, I'm so glad Riley shows up in this finale. I think it's a very fitting end to his character, and a very emotional and, like you said, rich ending to Erin's character, and just all the emotions and stuff that goes on in her final moments, and watching the life fade from her eyes, and knowing that, you know, no one knows what happens when you die, mm-hmm. and what Erin chooses to believe, like, kind of, I would say, in some sense, like, she knows she's going to a good place.
Yeah.
At the end, which is super, like, sad, because you just know, like, because you're watching the life fade from her eyes. You don't want her to die. Mm-hmm. It's super powerful stuff that just fucking ruined me. It fucking, like, tore me up inside.
Yeah, I know. It was a rough first watch, but rough in the best ways. Like, just incredible, but so emotional. And now, you know, we're coming to the end of the episode. It's like, all right, how much more can happen? Not too much besides, you know, the big ending, but we do get to see more closure for a few of the characters. So now kind of everyone knows the sun is going to come up. They have nowhere to go. And it's an interesting moment because I guess we know that Annie and Ed are kind of accepting of what's going on, but it seems like everyone else is as well, just because they just start singing. And it seems like not a totally sad moment.
Yeah. We get this whole vibe, I think, that's portrayed after the rec center burns, when there's nowhere mm-hmm. to go, that, okay, the chaos has settled.
Yeah.
What's going on? What's important to people? Like, we see Dolly and Wade are like, let's go find Lisa. Like, we don't know. And not in the way of like, let's go find Lisa and turn her.
Either. Yeah.
It's like, let's go be with our daughter, because like, that's what's important to us. You know, Sturge is like, he takes Howard. He's like, come on, Howie, let's go. But he mm-hmm. also finds Uker, you know, Warren's best friend, who is completely distraught with himself. And he's like, I think I killed my mom. And Sturge is like, I did some, and he's like, it's not important as to what mm-hmm. he did exactly, right? But he's just like, I did some stuff. And this idea of forgiveness that we've been talking about is on showcase here, because Sturge is just like, will you forgive me? And Uker's like, yeah, I will. And those three go off, and Bev's just kind of left on her own, as she should be, to experience the end of her life, because fuck Bev. But yeah, all the people kind of gather in town square, more or less. And yeah, they start singing, and they start singing this hymn called Nearer My God to Thee, which is, again, we're not religious people, but man, just the way this entire town is just gathered together singing the song, and they're like, yeah, we're going to meet our maker now. Like, this mm-hmm. is the end of our journey. Nearer, my God, to thee. And I was like, okay, I'm going to look this up because I wanted to know the name of it. And yeah. I came across an interesting fact. This is the song in Titanic, the movie. We don't know. I'm not sure if this is actually on the Titanic, the real Titanic. But in the,
right.
in the Titanic movie, the violinists start to play this song as the ship is going down. And I was like, God, that makes this whole scene even fucking sadder.
I know. I'm like, what is the background of the song? Is it supposed to be, oh, like, I guess you're near to God?
Yeah, like it's the
like
end
you're
of,
coming to, okay.
Right, like you're coming to meet him. It is the end of their time, I guess. But, you know, the religious meanings, I think, behind it are important. We're just, you know, ourselves, we don't necessarily know.
Yeah.
But the fact that I learned they played it in the Titanic movie, like, made this even sadder because it's like, okay.
As you're accepting.
Yeah, it's like, that's it. That's it. Our time is up. And, you know, we get... we get a couple characters. We get Hassan and Ali, or Sheriff Hassan and Ali. They go to the beach, and they start to pray. And like, they're both, it seems to me in the moment, they're just like, I'm sorry for what I did. Like, mm-hmm. forgive me. I want, you know, forgiveness. And obviously Sheriff Hassan is suffering from two gunshot wounds. We got this super sad scene that fucking, it's so minor, but it fucking killed me inside because of how much I loved Sheriff Hassan as a character, where they're praying. And as he goes, I'm not too sure of the actual religious terms.
But just when he's kneeling.
Right. As he's kneeling, he just falls over and he dies. And I'm like, fuck, God damn it.
The little detail really hit.
So good from Flanagan and this directing and the cinematography. And Ali is there. His father's gone, and now it's his turn to meet death his way. You know, we see Warren and Lisa on a boat. They're kind of just seeing as everything is going on. They see the angel trying to fly away with its clipped wings. And Lisa's like, can it make it? Like, what's going on? And Warren's like, I don't know, but like, I wouldn't think so. It's got to fly 30 miles. But that's going on. The townspeople are still singing. The song is playing throughout this entire thing, and it continues to grow and grow in sound and numbers because the entire townspeople are more or less singing the song along. Sheriff Hassan and Ali's final moments together, who stumbles upon them but Bev? And Bev sees, you know, two Muslims praying in their religion and their belief. And, like, to me in that moment, I was like, good, fuck you, Bev. Like, you've lost your sense of religion and what means most important to you. Mm-hmm. But for these two people of another faith, they still have their faith in their final moments. And Bev is just watching it all transpire. And as that's going on and the sun is starting to rise, she's like, okay, well, I guess that's it, right? But no, not for Bev. Bev's like, crap, what can I do? And she starts to dig into the ground and try to, like, you know, bury herself to protect herself from the sunlight. Like, very kind of like Bill Compton-esque, like in season one of True Blood, where she's like, I gotta save myself. I gotta bury you and, you know, you'll come back. But... yeah, as like it's so sad. Give me your thoughts on it. I know I've talked a lot because there's a lot of imagery going on here, but the way the whole thing kind of comes to a closure is fucking. It's dark. It's so sad. And I don't think a show ended in a way that has like stuck with me more in recent memory than Midnight Mass.
Oh, yeah. And this is why it's so good. It's a mini series. So it's not like the 10th season and we know the ending is going to disappoint everyone. No, this is just fantastic. And yes, I absolutely loved Bev's final scene. It was so good. And I think, too, it's like throughout the show, she kept saying, like, you know, people have to die. This is just what's happened. Like, yep, Joe Colley, you know, God this, God that. But when it is her time to die, she will not accept it. She tries to bury herself, and I think it's just fantastic because it just shows what kind of person she is as if we didn't know. But it's just another way to show that, and I just love it. And obviously she does not make it, and I think it's so powerful too that, like you were saying, everyone was singing, and when Lisa and Warren are on the boat watching everything happen, as the sun comes up, the singing just abruptly stops, which we know everyone died, and I think they understand that as well. And it's crazy, and they're just looking, and then there's so much debris that's coming from the fire and from everyone kind of being set ablaze on the island. And our final part of this show is just Lisa and Warren. They look pretty relieved to be getting out of there. Obviously, they're going to be starting a new life together without their family, without anyone they've known. And as they're kind of watching the ash fall down, Lisa tells Warren that she can't feel her legs, and she smiles. She looks very relieved about it.
Yeah. Ah, fuck. Like,
why did that happen? Tell me your analysis.
Yeah, I don't know. And we'll talk about it. We'll give our final thoughts. But the way, like you mentioned, the abrupt stopping of the song, it just, I was like, fuck. Everyone's dead. And like we all, like, you know it's coming because the sun is rising and you know everyone's about to die, but the way he did it with the idea of everyone together in the community is singing the song together, and it just goes quiet, and just knowing that it's the end, it's fucking brilliant. It's amazing the way that the ending is done. You know, we don't really see anyone really burn. The only character we see burn is the one that we all wanted to see burn, which is Bev. We see her face kind of melt in the same way that Riley did in the boat with Aaron. And, you know, as a viewer, I was like, okay, maybe you could give me like 3 or 4 more seconds of Bev burning. Just like, I wanted to see the full thing of like, okay, yeah. Do they just like turn into ash? You know, we see Ali kind of start to light up a little bit. You know, some of the people in town. It's more the singing to show that, you know, that's it. Everyone's dead except for Bev, which I love. And it's so heartbreaking to me in that moment. And we can start talking about what it means. Because, like, the thing we know about Lisa, of how, well, we don't know much of her life, you know, pre the shooting, and then after the shooting, we just meet her as she's, you know, wheelchair bound and paralyzed. But it seems that when we meet her, we know that she's kind of accepting of her life and what her life is now and how important religion is to her.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she gets the ability to walk again, it means this whole new found thing in life of being able to forgive people, forgive Joe Collie for what he did to her and everything like that. And it seems like now she has a new way of looking at the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, when she loses her feeling in her legs again, that brings her the most joy, it seems, in those final moments, because to her it means that this entire nightmare is over.
Mm-hmm.
Which is like a massive amount of like emotions that are thrown in, because it's like you lost this newfound feeling once again. It also means your parents are dead, but it also means that this nightmare is over, and you know you've survived, and it's, you know, you won in the end.
You're gonna be okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's just so many conflicting emotions that just combine into me being just a mess, and everybody who watches is a mess, I think, because there's so many things to process. Now we can talk about those emotions and processing them. But what does it mean essentially? Because, like, has the blood worn off? Like, does that mean that the angel is dead and that anyone connected to the angel's blood in that sort of sense now loses their powers and stuff like that? Maybe. It's left open to interpretation. Does she not actually have feeling in her legs? I think that's also maybe up for discussion. Is it more of her saying, like, I can't feel my legs. This is how life was before all of this. And now that it's gone, maybe, you know, maybe she's saying that in a sense of like, it's over. I don't know. I think that's probably the least likely thing. I think she actually can't feel her legs anymore.
Mm-hmm.
That's something I just thought of. What does it mean to you? Because I think you are my therapist in this situation as I'm unloading all of these emotions that I'm feeling.
Yeah, so I definitely tried to make sense of it pretty early on. And I mean, the most basic explanation, which I think it applies, is just that whatever power the island had just doesn't exist anymore. So everything is kind of restored to how it was before. And I initially did think that, okay, the angel died. That is kind of a logical explanation. But I do have a quote from Mike Flanagan, because I had to look up some answers here. And he, when the show came out, he talked to the Wrap about the ending, and he said, "We're not saying the angel died. Our hope really there was just to say that Lisa's concentration in her blood had begun to tip back, that she was going to be okay." So he doesn't even want to give answers. It's up to interpretation. They're not saying one way or the other, but yeah.
I think we know from like the show's lore that if you don't keep taking the blood and dying, like if you don't die with the blood in your system, it will fade over time. Mm-hmm. But you know, because they've been ingesting so much of it through mass and stuff, they've been able to keep the effects of it. So maybe mm-hmm. that's that. But of course, for it to happen kind of in that moment would be,
a little strange.
Right. It's a little coincidental. But also, like, you know, it's not really fair to combine show lores, but like, you know, in Vampire Diaries, when, and you know, we'll get, and this will be a whole part of our discussion of the show in the end now. In Vampire Diaries, when the creator of the vampiric line dies, every vampire in that line also dies.
Like so, the White Walkers.
Right. So, yeah, exactly. White Walkers. So it could be a sense of like that, like the source of the blood is gone. Now everybody doesn't have that effect anymore. But now that you said what Flanagan said, we don't know if the angel is necessarily dead. But also, yeah, it wouldn't make sense because John had died that would play any theory into it, because John wasn't the source of the blood. It was the angel. So I don't know. But I love that it's kind of ambiguous in that sense. And I also just love that full circle of completion here in Lisa's arc, where something that ruined her life is now a sign of the end, you know, of this nightmare. It's like powerful stuff to admit in that moment, but I think it works beautifully. But also fucking kills me inside, because like she's happy to not be able to walk again, which is not what we would think, because we saw the emotions of what it meant to her to walk again. It's, oh God, Flanagan. What do you I'd say, what do you think? I'll charge you by the hour for this, by the way. It's just, and I'm here if you want to talk about it as well. It's just, oh God, it's so heavy.
Yeah, I really do love it, though. I really do.
Yeah, it's what an ending to the show. And yeah, that's how it ends. The entire island, you know, as we saw from aerial shots of it kind of lighting up throughout the episode, and just at the end, the entire thing is ablaze. And it's hard to tell kind of what is on fire, what isn't on fire, what is people. We do see some like light emitting to kind of show that is the people leaving Earth. But, you know, it's more of the ash that is kind of flying around at the end in the air that shows that everyone is gone. That is the end of Midnight Mass. It just ends on that line of, I can't feel my legs anymore. And them kind of rejoicing that it's all over. And, All right. Wow.
I know, it's so much to digest.
It's the best show I've watched in years.
Yeah, me too. I know, I'm like, okay, it's the best show I've watched this year by far, but like, when was the last time I watched the show this good? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's been a long time.
The Leftovers, so I like during COVID and stuff like that, like right before COVID, I watched The Leftovers and I loved that show. And I started watching that because I enjoyed Watchmen a lot. But I had some issues with Watchmen when it came to just like I was a big fan of the movie and the book growing up, but I was more a fan of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's a big time jump, and a lot of the themes that the show goes into are like masterfully done by Lindelof, and like Regina King and Yahya Abdul-Mateen are amazing in that show. But I was like, okay, wait, I'm confused as to what's going on here. I needed to be more enveloped in that lore to really enjoy that show. When I watched The Leftovers, that show ruined me. I was like, God, this is amazing. And that was part of, you told me to watch that show. I think with Matan, one of our our coworkers, not exactly our boss, but our boss.
Yeah.
And then I watched Lost during COVID with my girlfriend, and the ending of Lost, I couldn't stop crying during the ending of Lost. I was just a wreck the entire show, and it became a whole thing for both of us to say, "I'll see you in another life, brother," and that was our thing for months.
Brother, yes.
But this show, front to back, is the best thing I've seen, I think, since The Leftovers, and The Leftovers for me is in my top three TV shows I've ever seen. So I think that makes Leftovers 3. This 2. Or maybe 1. Because Lost is up there for me too. So is Breaking Bad. So many things. But
it's so hard just because this is like a perfect show, right? But there's only 7 episodes. So it's so hard to compare it. Like The Leftovers, I love that show. But I really like season 1. And then it kind of went downhill for me.
Yeah. Apologies to everyone listening. We're going to go into a huge discussion now about this. Because, like, for me, it's not fair to just compare this show to other horror media that we've watched. Because it transcends it. It is not just a horror series. I loved The Queen's Gambit. I thought The Queen's Gambit was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just, like, comparing to different miniseries.
Right. Like, if I were to say the best things that Netflix has done over the past 10 years or so, or whatever, right? I would go this, Hill House, Queen's Gambit, Stranger Things, I think would be my top 4 when it comes to original Netflix series that are produced. And I don't know if it's recency bias or whatever, but for me, that is the best of those 4. And I love Stranger Things, and I love Hill House, and I love Anya Taylor-Joy and The Queen's Gambit, but this front to back just fucking ruined me. And I think that's what I appreciate about it so much. It's like, it's very sadistic.
No, definitely. I think it goes places that most shows do not at all. And you know, I know we weren't really fans of Bly Manor. I wasn't that big of a fan of Hill House. It was fine. So to me, yeah, this is just one of the best things I've seen in forever. And I do love that it obviously says something that we're comparing it to just our favorite shows of all time.
Yeah, I think Squid Game also gets thrown in there because Squid Game is on a lot of hype right now. And I liked Squid Game, but for those people who were like, Squid Game is the best thing I've ever seen, like, go watch the original Battle Royale, go watch more Korean media, because there's a whole world of amazing Korean media out there that people probably haven't taken in. Like, I think the one thing, like, Parasite is definitely up there when I'm like, if people haven't watched, like, Korean film or TV show before, or TV shows, or Japanese media or anything like that, right? Like, go watch all that stuff because there's stuff out there that is just as amazing as it. But Parasite definitely transcended, I think, a lot of that stuff.
The
mainstream, like, American consumption of media. And I think Squid Game is a little overhyped. I really liked it, but Midnight Mass for me topped Squid Game infinitely. And if anybody should watch both, like, what I'm trying to say is I hope this show gets the praise and love that it deserves.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's gotten really, really great ratings and, you know, Rotten Tomato score, everything like that. I think it's gotten great reviews. There are a few that weren't so great. I remember seeing, I'm not going to drop any names of publications because I don't want to be wrong. But yeah, and it's interesting too, though, because I wouldn't recommend this to everyone. I think, and not to be like a snob here, but you need a very different level of emotional intelligence to get through this. So I wouldn't just be like, you know, you want something fun to watch, watch Midnight Mass, you know what I mean? So it definitely is more of a niche audience, I would say. But that niche is me.
We are niche. We are said niche. Yeah, I think people who are just like scrolling through Netflix and they come across it and they're kind of like, maybe I'll try this. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're necessarily ready for it.
Yeah.
And I wasn't either because I didn't know anything about the show going into it. I just knew there was religious horror, more or less, and it was Flanagan, right? And we do urge that people go into the show not knowing anything about it.
Yeah, totally.
But you do need to be aware of, like, okay, strap in, get yourself in the right mindset for it, and enjoy the ride, because it is seven masterful episodes of directing, acting, writing, photography, any word of anything anybody on this show worked
on. The Lady Gaga gif where she's just like, amazing, outstanding.
Exactly.
Like, just all of the
superb,
words.
Fantastic. It's everyone who worked on the show, a round of applause to you, because you did an amazing job at bringing this seven episode series to life. And like, I don't know. I love this show so much. It's like the world's not a better place because the show was made, or like, you know, it's like, it's not like, it's just like all of these things that, I think we're so grateful to everybody who worked on the show, and made this. And it was such a pleasant surprise from what we thought of Bly Manor. And I want to go back and rewatch that now. Maybe we'll revisit it together. Maybe not. Maybe you won't watch it again.
Yeah.
But like, Hill House definitely bought into that Netflix hype. And I think it, you know, got into an area where I liked Hill House a lot. But it was the point where like people were just like begging for something from Netflix that was going to be scary. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I necessarily didn't need the show to be any scarier than it was. It wasn't like it was the scariest thing in the world, but it was just beautiful storytelling in a terrifying setting. Again, Hamish, let's be best friends. Like, come on.
I know. I think, too, this is just a really great, I guess, endorsement for Mike Flanagan, because he's done so many adaptations and this is an original work, and it's like, stick to you write it, you have better ideas, you know. And I know that his next project is an adaptation, so that one, I mean, that'll be interesting in itself because it's based on a young adult book, but he should just, you know, keep cranking out his own stories. It's impressive.
Yeah, and let's be honest, like, we are not innocent in the sense of like, okay, we liked Hill House. We did it. We bought into the hype of whatever the next one was going to be, right? And we set our own expectations. And if they didn't meet those expectations, we were going to have thoughts about it one way or the other. That is the world that existed long before Game of Thrones season 8. But that was the reality of like, okay, people had set into that mindset who loved that show because it was the most popular show for years. Mm-hmm. And they all built it up. And once it was over, they were like, oh, what is this thing? We are setting expectations and we are enjoying things too much and we want things. And when they don't do the things that we want, we get upset and angry about it. Oh, that's a feeling. We've all done it. Everyone has done it. It's just that I feel like that show made it that mainstream type of vibe now. So much to the fact now that people don't even like, people forget about Game of Thrones in that sense where they're like, that's not my favorite show anymore because it was ruined for me. But like, this is a great example of don't have any expectations about anything. Just go watch a show and enjoy it because it will surprise you. And, yeah, that's a lot of talk about the show and what we feel about it. We didn't necessarily talk about the lore a lot. The one question I think we both have is vampire or angel? What is this creature?
Yeah, I mean, when I watched it, I immediately thought vampire, but then I was like, nah, that's stupid. I don't think it's actually vampire. I think I've just watched too much vampire media.
Say it. Vampire.
Yeah. So I was pretty surprised when the show came out and people were mentioning vampires. I was like, okay, I'm not that crazy. But I do think that it was supposed to be an angel, just because I know, you know, looking back at old kind of illustrations and of angels, they were scary looking and not like the little cherub that we see, you know, today and everything like that. So I think that it was an angel, but I haven't done my biblical research into it enough to really know for sure. And even if I have, I wouldn't have known for sure.
Yeah. Have you seen Legion?
No.
Okay.
I know what you're talking about, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, the movie, not the TV show. Angels are kind of portrayed in that way as well a little bit.
Okay.
But more... also different. Obviously, it's different. No one knows what angels look like. It's all up to our imaginations. But I think I'm also on the board of Angel. There's definitely some vampiric sense and themes that go on throughout the entire show that could lead people to believe it might be a vampire. I'm glad that it's either Flanagan's like, yeah, it's an angel,
mm-hmm.
or it's whatever you want it to believe it is.
Yeah.
Because that's what the show is about. It's about what you believe. And the idea of what religion does to people, and not religion is an evil thing, which is fantastic. And what we've talked about a bunch throughout the course of our review. If you're super religious or if you're not religious, like, it has nothing to do with you're bad if you believe it and you're good if you don't believe it or anything like that. It's just, this is how religion affects a community. Whoa, someone's at your door?
Literally a truck outside my window.
Nice. Welcome to New York City. XOXO. Gossip Girl.
Gossip Girl.
No,
I agree with you, though. And I think, like, you know, you and I aren't religious people. I won't get into my beliefs about religion. But I'm not a religious person saying, I'm so glad they didn't attack religion. No, I'm not a religious person. And I think it's very interesting that they didn't attack religion. It's just something we haven't really seen before.
Yeah, for what we know of, like, religion in shows, it's, like, The Exorcist and all those types of things. Natalie's muted her mic and is now smiling because the truck will not stop honking its horn.
beep, beep.
Yeah. but, yeah, like, The Omen, The Exorcist, shows like that, where it's, like, this idea of religion and the devil and the Antichrist and all that type of stuff. The show doesn't do that. The show shows... like, this is religion. This is an abstract thing, and this is how people believe one way or the other. And, you know, here is this Christian island in this community, and here are two Muslims and how they react to society, and how does someone who is young of a different religion cope, or not cope, but interact with people of a different community who are very religious, and how curious Ali is to the whole idea. And it's so... awesome to see how all these characters are written and portrayed, and everyone does an amazing job. And again, the show is amazing. It's brilliant. It's a 10 out of 10 for me.
That was going to be my next question. So out of 10, I'm going to say, can I do 0.5 or should I just...
Okay, let's 9.5 from both of us.
Yes.
People can tell if they listen to our multi-episode review of this show, we were a lot less critical on some things than we've been in other reviews. Go listen to our Day of the Dead review. I gave that a 0. but yeah, there are some things in the show that aren't exactly perfect, but everything else that is so good about it overshadows it.
Yeah, I mean, it's close enough. I don't even think I have not to go back into the whole discussion of other shows, but I don't think I would give any show a 10. Just because shows go on for so long, there's so much room for mistakes. It's easier to give a movie a 10 than a show.
That's fair. 9.5, I think, is the fairest grade. It is the highest grade we will give to something this year by far, and easily, because it is the best thing we've watched this year. But yeah, it's, you know, again, also to people who are like, you don't have to think critically about something and, you know, you could just enjoy it. I'm like, or you can just think critically and choose not to think critically about things. It's like, whatever. But, like, that's what we do on this podcast. We think critically about some things. And shows and movies that we watch. So, you know, it's not to say we didn't think critically about it because we just love this so much. It's just that it is as close to a perfect 7-episode miniseries that you're going to get, I think, in our minds. It is amazing. Hats off to everybody involved in the show, once again, from both of us.
Yeah.
And we want to meet all of you and talk to you. And Flanagan, I feel like Flanagan, you know, it's kind of like Eminem's Without Me. It's like, guess who's back? Back again. Like, everyone's like, oh, Flanagan made Blind Manor. He stinks. Nah, like, this is what Flanagan is capable of. Go watch Oculus.
Yeah, I love that movie.
feel like people don't talk about that movie a lot.
I know, yeah. I think it's his my favorite movie of his because I wasn't too big on Gerald Graham or Hush.
Yeah, I think our coworker Noam also hit us with his hot take way back when. That was one of our first episodes of like horror hot takes. When he said Oculus is the best thing Flanagan has ever done, which at the time people would have said Hill House because it was so widely acclaimed by everybody. Was on that Netflix hype train, but for me this is the best thing he's ever done. Do more things like this. That would be an awesome interview one day, Flanagan. If you're out there listening through the grapevine, anything, just you know, hit us up. We'll hit you up. Our people will talk to your people. We don't have people to talk to other people, but you know, that would be awesome one day. And Hamish, you're invited to come on the show whenever if you're listening. He seems like such a cool person in all the interviews I've seen on YouTube. I don't know if you've seen him do some, but
no.
I think he did one with Samantha Sloyan, who also would love to talk to her because when we talked to Crystal Balint, she said that the one character she would play outside the show that she didn't play would be Bev. She wanted to play Bev.
Yeah.
And I would love to talk to Samantha about playing Bev and getting in that mindset, because that's got to be one of the hardest characters. Like, that's what Crystal said. It was like, I would love to try to play that character.
Mm-hmm.
It is a very hard character to get across on screen and to hate that much as a viewer. And I think Samantha Sloyan did an amazing job. I'd love to talk to everybody and anybody. Come on the show. Can you tell that we love this show? We love this show so much. It is amazing.
It is. So I think, yeah, solid 9.5 is very fair. And everyone listening, just know next review we come with will not have this high of praise. So take it all in. Enjoy it. And yeah, I don't think we have anything on the docket yet for next week, but we'll figure that out. And any last thoughts before we wrap up the episode? Besides anyone from the show, come on.
Anybody on the show, you want to come hang out? Let's see, final thoughts. Once again, thank you to everyone on that show who worked on it. It was amazing. It was a fantastic watch. And yeah, I don't know what we're going to review now. I pity the next thing we review, because we will not be as kind. No, that's not how we operate. I hope everyone enjoyed our review. I hope if you listen to our review and then weren't too sure if you want to watch it. I talked to somebody at a Halloween party. I don't know if I mentioned this before. A couple weeks ago. And they were talking about how, like, I think it's too scary for me. I don't know if I would enjoy it. Like, I'm not that big of a horror fan. Like, the jump scares really get to me. And I was like, there's, like, 3 jump scares. Mm-hmm. Watch it and enjoy it, because like you need to experience it. I think everybody would benefit from experiencing the show, and just the way it just starts and ends, it's brilliant. Thank you everyone who listened. I don't know what we're going to review next. What are we going to review next?
It won't come close to this, that's for sure. But yeah, thank you everyone for listening. We had so much fun talking about this show because we love it so much. Even though we have fun destroying some shows, it's a lot more fun to talk about things that we love, and we rarely get to do it because there's not too many things that are on this level in horror this year, at least, that we've talked about. So we'll come back with something fun for you guys. But in the meantime, thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next.